Dr. Nick Begich, and I'm with a new program today, Changing the Way We See the World, with Dr. Nick. And we're talking about a lot of technologies these days. That's what people know me from in my appearances on many radio programs around the country, many on this network. And today we're going to try to lead off with an opening program where I'm actually going to be hosting a program, bringing in some of the people that I know from around the world that can add to the dialogue on the impact of technologies in the 21st century. And I think that's the main thing we want to talk about today. We're going to take call-ins as we go through the conversation. And I think that today's topic, one of the big issues of the day, for me at least, has always been sort of what's been happening with energy policy and the development of energy policy as it affects the country and now certainly every consumer on the planet. So I want to lead off today with a discussion of the impacts of energy policy, kind of what's happening as it affects all of us. And I'm calling in and hosting from Alaska, which is my home, and I have a long history here. You know, Alaska provides about 20% of the energy needs for the United States in terms of domestic production, and that's from the Trans-Alaska pipeline that was built back in the early 1970s. You know, there's a lot of things people are unaware of in terms of oil policy in Alaska that affects all of us in the country. The pipeline was built with a capacity of 2 million barrels of oil per day, which at one point we were actually transferring through the pipeline. Right now it's running at about half of that capacity, not because of necessarily a shortage of oil, but a question of where oil, the oil industry really wants to pull that oil from. I mean, the idea of increasing the capacity of the line is already there. There's a couple of bottlenecks that the public is not aware of that are really driving energy prices right now. One of those is refining capacity, which has been diminished not because of just idleness in the industry, but because of international growth, particularly demand for refined products in China and in Asia because of the expansion of their economies. Now, what's happened in all of that when you start to look at the history of Alaska and oil policy here. You know, the very beginnings of our state, and I was born here actually, well, it was still a territory. And my father came up from, father and mother from the Midwest and settled here as a territory. It was emerging pretty rapidly, and they had discovered oil in Cook Inlet, South Central Alaska, which eventually led to statehood here. But oil, as a commodity, was discovered much before that on the north slope of Alaska in a place called the National Naval Petroleum Reserve. And this reserve was set up back in the early 50s because oil was observed actually seeping onto the surface of the ground. And this is actually, if you look at a map of Alaska and you look on the left side of Prudhoe Bay, which is this area known for oil production in Alaska now, on the left side of the map is a vast area the size of some states that is, in fact, the National Naval Petroleum Reserve. On the right side of the Prudhoe Bay is the Anwar, that area that's currently in discussion in the Congress and a lot of controversy surrounding whether or not we should develop it. But the point being, oil has been here in huge quantities. It continues to be available in Alaska. If you look at the whole state, almost a third of it is oil basin, not including the offshore reserves that have been mapped here in Alaska. When you start to look at getting oil out of Alaska, going back to the oil embargo of the 70s, and those of us that remember that, it was right around the same time there was a lot of debate in the Congress about the oil line in Alaska, and it had actually passed on a 50-50 tie vote in the Senate to build the pipeline in the first place, with Agnew actually breaking that tie. Now, when you look back again sort of historically on what was happening at that time, that was about the same time that Nixon was getting thrown out of office. A lot of corruption dealing with the oil industry. Prices for fuel went sky high. The Middle East was forming up their power grip on Western economies based upon our demand for energy resources. So there was a lot going on in the 70s that almost is repeated again today in a different set of circumstances.
Don't say words
much. Changing the way the world with Dr. Nick Begich. It's good to be on the air today with folks talking about energy issues and the history of energy policy as it affects the country from an Alaskan perspective. You know, what I was saying just before the break, and in terms of what was happening in the early 70s, is really being repeated again today. When you look at sort of the things that are being pushed, you know, there's a great emphasis on on the profits and margins that are being made by the oil industry, and part of that is, I think, sort of seeing the handwriting on the wall. At the same time that energy prices are inflating, the possibilities in terms of alternatives are also increasing. A great deal is being done to kind of look at what you do to convert an energy industry, and the industry would like to maintain control of that. You know, it's an international business that transfers huge amounts of wealth from one part of the world to another. You know, in the old days, in the 70s, all oil was traded in U.S. dollars. Today, and more recently, in the last 2 years, oil has been traded in euros in mixed economies, which have limited the amount of dollars being sucked up, literally keeping the supply down and the dollar inflated. When they start to take mixed currencies, more dollars go into circulation unless the price of oil escalates enough to sort of suck up the difference, which is what we've seen in the market. The dollar still slides. You see oil prices inflate. Companies are making huge amounts of money, the kind of money that will be necessary when they look to capitalize the next energy economy. And they're pushing, of course, for a hydrogen economy based on the same hydrocarbon fuel sources as in the past, whether it be natural gas or other products. And the fact is, there's a lot of ways to address energy that could solve our problems domestically, utilizing supplies that are here, just taking a better look, a more clear look at the companies behind the industry, because they don't have national alliances. These are global companies that really look at it from a standpoint of bottom line profit. In the case of the oil industry in the 70s, when they finally got the pipeline passed, there were certain restrictions. One of them was none of the oil could be exported. All had to be refined domestically and available for domestic use, because we had just come through the energy crisis and we didn't want to have that problem again. But the reality is, just a few years ago, they changed that. The Congress went in, modified before we were in this energy pinch again, and gave the industry the opportunity to export that oil, which most of which is now exported. And the refineries that used to be able to accommodate Alaskan crude have been modified, so they couldn't accommodate it now without significant changes anyway. So you've got a limited production. You've got the pipeline in Alaska running at half capacity. You have limited refining capacity of the kind of oil that Alaska produces, and no new refineries being built on the coast. And then the third leg is after the Exxon Valdez spill, which many remember for the horrible crisis that it created in our part of the world. But, you know, that spill's over 16 years old, and the last settlement, the court judgments, have still not been paid by Exxon. It's been 16 years, and the settlement has not been paid out. Now, that's a pretty embarrassing situation for a company that made more than that settlement in a couple of months. And, you know, when you look at that side of it, after the Valdez spill, double-hull tankers are required to ship U.S. oil by a certain point in the future, which we've now reached. And here's the thing about double-hull tankers, is there's not enough of them to move the oil, even if we could run it through the pipeline, because the industry hasn't recognized the need to do it, nor been forced to do it. So the reason that we're in the problem we're in isn't so much related to domestic supply of oil. It has to do with the politics of oil. And right now in Alaska, we are having, for the first time since statehood virtually, one of the biggest debates on oil taxation policy that will totally change the picture for this public resource. Because that's the other factor that people forget, is these energy resources ultimately belong to each of us. It's a public resource that we lease to our tenants, the oil industry, who is theoretically supposed to produce this in a reasonable and responsible way. And therein lies perhaps the problem, is that if we haven't recognized that sufficiently and looked at what is going on in the rest of the world in terms of the relationship of the oil industry to governments and to the public that they represent. And I think that's what we're missing a lot of the debate on energy policy. And then at the same time looking at, you know, what is in the national interest? You know, is it in the national interest to export huge amounts of dollars in exchange for trade deficits that are totally out of control? Or, and looking at those trade deficits, how much of that is related to energy? And you'll see that a major portion of it is. And so the consequence of that, and sort of the artificial propping up of that, is if you export Alaskan oil, well, you import someone else's. And there's reasons the industry does this. One of them is that they sell oil, for instance, to Japan that maybe can accommodate a heavy crude or like Alaska produces, and then you ship it from, say, Nigeria to the East Coast to transfer it to an East Coast company, and then you release a shipment of oil from Alaska to Japan. You cut off the transportation factor in between. And this is the kind of thing the industry does routinely. It's part of the way the trade of oil works. But again, the beneficiary of this, these trade arrangements are the industry and not necessarily the national interest. And this is where we run into the bottlenecks because there's not enough incentive. You know, 5-6 years ago, if you called for a tanker in Alaska, you could get a choice of 7 or 8 or even maybe as many as 10 to haul your oil. Today, you're lucky to find one because of the global demand for refined products. And then you look at what we've spent to try and solve the problem, and it's pretty limited. I mean, you look at Alaska in terms of resources to really isolate not just the energy resources, but how they might be developed. And some of the biggest resources available in the country deal with not hydrocarbons, but things like geothermal fuel. You know, in terms of energy availability, if you look throughout the Rocky Mountains, thermal hot springs exist in many, many locations. And these are essentially the Earth's fuel sources that last tens of thousands of years. And so tapping these energy resources for generating electricity, something well known in many parts of the world, even for cracking hydrogen out of water. In fact, in Iceland, it's one of the main ways that they develop their energy resources. When you look at Iceland's situation with geothermal, what you see is not only the production of most of the electricity that is generated in Iceland, but also the excess electricity generated from those power plants create hydrogen at in the evening that runs their public transit system, and they're now experimenting with even utilizing it in passenger cars in that part of the world. And so here's a solution based upon a country that produces no other natural resource in terms of energy production because they're essentially volcanic based island. But we have 2,000 miles of those types of islands in Alaska, known as the Aleutian Chain. What we don't have right now is a way to transfer easily electrical energy from that location, say, to the western states. But we certainly have the ability to produce huge amounts of hydrogen at very, very low cost and export that to the United States using geothermal. And in that area, even wind, because these are uninhabited or limited habitation, in some cases no habitation on some of the islands, and tremendous wind velocity based upon the way the ocean currents roll through that area. And these are, you know, these are the old technologies that have been around for years that were economically viable when oil was much less than it is today. And when you look at other breakthroughs in solar energy, where we could again tap huge amounts of energy, have become cheaper and less expensive to produce to the point where today investment in infrastructure would result in a great deal of relief. It could be done relatively quickly, not talking tens of years, but in over a very short duration. You know, one of the other big issues up here, not just the oil taxation issue that's taking place in a special session of our legislature right now in Juneau, but there's also a discussion about a new gas line to bring gas from the North Slope of Alaska all the way down to the central states, which, you know, the price of natural gas, people have seen what's happened in that. The problem is the industry is trying to get both state and federal guarantees. And you know, the history of building these kinds of pipelines is pretty phenomenal. I mean, we've been able to see the original Alaska gas oil line was built without consideration for any gas line at that time. And they actually built it for $9 billion with a preliminary estimate of about $900 million. So it inflated 1,000% or 10 times. Right now, they're projecting a gas line cost from Alaska to the Midwest costing $20 billion. And if, you know, if they mess up like they normally do on these, because you're bringing it thousands of miles of territory, and it'll take probably by the time you're done with the lawsuit and the litigation, maybe 10 years to build. It's not going to provide the relief that the country needs immediately. And the fact is the industry has tied up those natural gas resources, 35 trillion cubic feet of proven reserves in the northern regions of Alaska for over 30 years, and there's never been a production requirement in the lease agreements with the state or federal government in the case of federal leases. And that's something that, again, the public is not generally aware of. We lease this, and then they basically lock it up. They don't produce it. When there's other small producers all over the country that would love to be able have an opportunity to produce some of these fields. And we're going to a break, and after the break, we'll take callers at 800-313-9443. Welcome back to Change the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And this is, for those that just tuned in or just tuned in, we're talking about energy issues and sort of the evolution of some of the energy policy that's now affecting the entire country. You know, there's a lot of things that happen when you start to think about sort of where all of this chases out. You know, one of the big issues in Alaska right now, another issue that sort of relates to all of this, is the stability of that Trans-Alaska pipeline. You know, most of it is actually elevated above the ground because of what's called permafrost, and this is frozen lenses of ice within the sometimes very deep into the surface of the earth, perhaps several hundred feet deep. But this ice is relatively stable because of the cold conditions in Alaska. But over the last 40 years, again, because of changes, environmental changes that we're seeing here in our part of the world, we've actually got some risk to the stability of the line. They keep shoring it up and replacing sections and doing a lot of work on it based upon the fact that permafrost at increasing rates is melting, destabilizing those raised portions of the line. You know, this is not a problem that's likely to go away. In my lifetime, being born here and watched the state change, literally 40% of the ice in our glaciers and in the ice cap in the north has disappeared. The other thing that's happened is because of longer summers. I mean, yesterday, as a matter of fact, we had a record-breaking day in terms of temperature, and that's sort of setting the tone for what we're expecting this summer. That increase, that change has happened where summers are now 3 or 4 weeks longer in my part of the state than they were when I was a kid. The ice pack in the north has changed dramatically, and what that does when you're in the northern regions in terms of permafrost, when you have white snow cover, it reflects most of the heat and light away, but when you have dark brown cover, it absorbs even more heat energy, and it sort of accelerates the process. And what it releases in the acceleration is a gas called methane, which is 20, 30 times more potent as a greenhouse gas than CO2, the things that we make with our cars. In other words, the natural effect of climate change in this current curve is adding way more to the problem than human beings are adding. And this issue isn't even being discussed in very many circles right now, just starting to get a little bit of visibility, but it's something that cannot be reversed. In other words, the changes that are going to affect climate, which ultimately then affect energy prices, because where it gets hotter or cooler in certain places, the need for heat energy or cooling energy or the need for energy for produce production, et cetera, actually increases. And this is where energy issues are not just about the cost of gasoline at the pumps today. It has a great deal to do with the cost of everything tomorrow and literally tomorrow. I mean, I think in the coming quarters, as you start to look at those inflation numbers based on the energy component, this is why we should be following at least a policy of national energy independence. So we don't even have a plan headed that direction right now. You know, the countries that did in the early 70s during the last energy crisis, countries like Brazil, are energy independent today and are not being crushed by the price of oil because they produce other domestic energy sources that are economic when oil was $20 a barrel and are very economic today because their cost didn't increase for those alternatives. You know, when you look at, again, national policy, how much money would it take to begin to convert an infrastructure to this kind of effort? Well, certainly significantly less than we're spending rebuilding a couple of countries right now in other parts of the world. You know, it baffles me. You know, we're watching our infrastructure deteriorate in the United States and the very infrastructures that can lend themselves to energy independence. And then the multinational corporations come in and want government support when they certainly don't need them right now. The other issue, an issue that's just made the papers in the last couple of days, is what's being pushed through the Bush administration for energy rights of way. These are for electrical utilities, oil and gas companies. Some of these right-of-ways are 5 miles wide and 2,000 miles long. And this is going to be like the railroad giveaways. You know, what do you need 5 miles of width in a right-of-way for that length to get a power transmission line through or a gas line through or an oil line through? It's a big, major giveaway, again, of public resources, in this case, thousands of square miles of land in the same way that we gave it to the robber barons of the railroad industry in the 1800s. We need to rethink these national resources in a way that allows us to maximize the public benefit from them. Right now, multinationals with no national interests are reaping those benefits and asking for more. It's the biggest corporate welfare program anybody's ever seen for an industry where it ought to be running in the reverse. We ought to be looking at that industry assisting in solving the problem as well. And there are some interest in doing that, but obviously the profit motive to come behind it. You know, what one country or another, and that is going to happen in our lifetimes, is going to continue to develop the alternatives, as Iceland has in the case of geothermal. Now they have technology that actually could be advanced even further and used in many places in the world. You know, small hydroelectric, not the big, giant projects, but the small hydroelectric projects used to run the entire rural America. That's why we had rural electrification programs in the 30s and 40s to advance that whole idea of small energy generation dispersed around the country. And that's been consolidated and actually consolidated in a way that makes us all dependent upon, again, huge companies that really don't have necessarily individual interest in part. It's not about Main Street. It's about Wall Street. And we're headed for a break. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. Welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. McBeggins. This is the first day of this program. We're going to be on every Wednesday in the same time slot for a couple of hours, talking about new technologies and their effect on all of us, and as well as those issues related to technologies. Many know me from my work with reporting on the HART project, reporting on cell phones and underwater sonars, and a lot of the things that the military has been doing in development of what are called non-lethal weapons. And we've been speaking quite a bit on energy and earth changes over the last year or so. Energy policy, for me, really started as a young person. My dad was involved here in Alaska in the state senate during the formative years after statehood, as well as in the U.S. Congress, when the first issues of oil and gas were being debated here in Alaska. That's kind of been the subject of our discussion today, and it really comes from a long family history and not only being involved in watching the legislation pass, but watching my family members write and enact that legislation that allowed certain aspects of this to take place. You know, back in the 70s, again, just after, just at the time the pipeline was being debated, one of the biggest issues that allowed that to even happen was called the Native Land Claims Settlement Act, which was an act that transferred 44 million acres and just under $1 billion in 1971 to organizations that represented the indigenous interests of Alaskans. There had never been any real reservations or settlement with the indigenous people here, so that was the first attempt to do it, and it turned into the largest settlement with indigenous in the history of the country. What happened as a result of that is then the oil industry could gain its right-of-way, its access to a pipeline corridor that would allow it to be built through Alaska without having to worry about lawsuits down the road. So that was sort of the first step. Dad passed that bill in his first year in the first term in the Congress, which was pretty amazing. You know, but what it was really about was a lot more than that, because buried in the bill were certain compromises, and those compromises allowed for discussion of what were called national interest lands, and this is like parks and preserves, like the ANWR, as a matter of fact. All of these were then developed over the course of succeeding administrations under the Carter administration that essentially locked up over 100 million acres of land in Alaska, a huge, huge amount of land, what we call national interest land. And interestingly enough, Carter, during his administration, actually looked over those lands and determined which ones had what were called strategic minerals. And we had 32 of the 33 strategic minerals in mineable quantities within those national interest holdings. And what happened when they transferred it in the middle 70s and into the 80s, when they began transferring these national interest land, it essentially assured that nobody would be able to develop them unless we were in a national crisis. And this is what's really important, because all of those rights, except for the energy rights, were available to any U.S. citizen, or in the case of Alaska's state holdings, any Alaskan citizen to go out and locate those valuable minerals and stake them and lay claim to them under the mining laws that are enacted in this country. But as a result of the public interest land status, these areas were then taken out of developmental possibilities. And in many cases, existing mines, like in the case of Kantishna in northern Mount McKinley area, were actually condemned and bought out under eminent domain arrangements by the federal government, many of which were very unfair. And the fact is, it locked all of these resources up in a way where the only companies that will ever develop them will be multinationals in times of national crisis, where regulation will be laid aside and the national interest will prevail, when actually the national interest would have prevailed had the market been applied to the development of resources here rather than reserves set up by multinationals. And the way I say reserves set up by them was based on the idea that multinational corporations through nonprofits such as the Rockefeller Foundation and some of the big foundations actually underwrote the environmental community for locking those lands up. And the environmental community was looking at it thinking, oh, isn't this wonderful? Well, it was part of that whole global view of the world. Well, it's nice to lock up a resource when you know you've got the political clout to unlock it, when you can't mine in Angola or Indonesia or some other place where we might get thrown out. And so it was done not for the average person's interest. Quite to the contrary, it was done for the interest of, again, multinational corporations. You know, there's a lot to energy policy, and I want to make sure we allow time for call-ins in this hour, so I want to get that number again. The call-in number is 800-313-9443. Again, it's 800-313-9443. And if you have questions about the issues we're talking about or comments, please call in. And if you've got ideas for future shows based upon your knowledge of what we've talked about in the past and things I've presented on in the past, I'd appreciate getting that feedback today. You know, going back again to this whole area of energy, when you start to look at the complexity of it, it really is not so complicated. It's really about what it takes to lock up resources and what motivates the companies behind. And, you know, like when you look at the corporation structures, when the founders were there and they had a philosophy that really lined up with the founders of those companies, I don't care who they were. They had the character of that individual sort of embedded in them. But as generations pass, what happens is that disappears. And what you have with corporations that regulate all of this debate and actually influence the political outcomes as well, you have living entities in one sense. I mean, they got all the rights of the human being in terms of the courts and due process. The only difference is they get to exist forever on Earth. We don't. The other thing they don't have is a soul and a conscience. They have a motivation driven by Wall Street's interests, which are about profit and money. And essentially, greed motivates the essence of And really, companies now that are bigger than nations, and this is incredibly an important shift because they don't have borders or boundaries. They don't have sovereignty in the same way that states do, but they're able to influence political outcomes within government. And then eventually, you know, governments wake up, and that's based on people waking up to the issues that affect all of us. You know, when you talk about energy policy, again, you remember before when Bush was first elected, there was all this discussion about new energy policy, and Cheney was involved in it. He just come over from Halliburton and gotten his $20 million severance package, which, you know, I mean, it's about as transparent as can be. But they went through all of this energy policy development, and then right at the time when everybody was screaming for them to release the information, we had a Gulf War begin, and we kind of forgot about it. But that information has still not been disclosed. You know, and what has energy policy resulted in, or the lack of policy? You know, we got oil at, you know, in the mid-80s, it was $8 and $9 during the low point in the mid-80s, and now it's $70 plus. You know, it's 1,000 times increase. And those increases are related to essentially restrictions on the market, the devaluation of the dollar, and that will continue. And that's where energy policy, take that equation, and you get it closer to zero instead of 35% of probably the entire U.S. economy. Right around that is centered on energy, whether it's the power grid or whether it's oil and gas. But energy as a component for everything is in our interest to try and figure out how to grab hold of that technology and not be the biggest importers of oil anymore, but perhaps the biggest exporters of hardware to take advantage of the technologies that this country certainly has the ability to advance and develop, whether it be the straightforward geothermals, hydroelectric, solar, wind, and then get into the more exotic ones. And this is interesting, as NASA back in 2000, as well as the British government, announced what has been previously classified programs looking for what's called zero-point energy, the energy that comes right out of the vacuum. And there's many researchers in many countries looking at this, whether it's the cold fusion effects, whether it's other dynamic effects of energy where you can get a lot of energy out or perhaps less energy in. And the other area that's breaking a lot of news from time to time is this idea of superconductivity. That's the ability to transfer energy from one place to another without any losses in the line transfer, which would be a big deal. That's why we can't transfer energy at these huge distances. Once you get over 600-700 miles, it's really inefficient and you start to lose too much. But if you could eliminate that line, then you could produce energy anywhere on the planet where it's generally available and then transfer it from one place to another with high level of efficiency. So you get away from transporting very inefficiently hydrocarbons, for instance, coal or other forms to generate electricity if you could use those geothermal sources. And when I talk about geothermal sources, within that range of distribution right now, you've got areas all through the Rockies that you could spread electrical energy both directions. And where it's needed in the Southwest, one of the biggest growing parts of our country, is where solar energy could easily be produced. And now economically, if we were shoving even 10% of the $2 trillion we're going to spend in Iraq and Afghanistan between what we've already spent and what's expected to be spent, for 10% of that, we could probably solve a major chunk of what motivated us to be there in the first place, which I think everyone agrees, or at least most people agree, it was really about oil. It wasn't about spreading democracy. You know, it's obvious countries, you know, have a right to self-determination, and the people there should determine what kind of government they want. You know, it's this idea of imposition for corporate interests that place our men and women at risk when we end up in conflicts that aren't motivated by pure American values that most of us hold in common. It's when corporate values, soulless values, take the lead and leave the public in the dust to fight over issues that aren't going to solve our long-term problems. And this is where corporate interests again corrupt the process. You know, when Dad was in the Congress, it was no different. I mean, back in those days, they didn't even have public disclosure of campaign contributions or anything else. You know, people remember who were around then, the bags of money carried around by the Nixon administration, literally bags of money that led to the reforms in political contribution. So we got away from the concepts of bribery, and we institutionalized concepts of contributions. And, you know, contributions and bribery really are more or less the same thing. When you think about it, what does it get you? It gets you access, influence, and outcomes, which is, in fact, the same thing a contribution gets you. If you go into your congressman's office, and I'd recommend everybody try it sometime. Go into your congressman's office and ask for a meeting to talk about something important to you. And unless you represent some big group, you're going to get a 30-second or one-minute conversation. But you go into that office and you write a check for $5,000 and lay it on the table and ask for an appointment and call it a contribution, I'll guarantee you'll get a better response than that. And that's what's wrong with the system, is money allows and motivates access. That limits the average person's ability to influence outcome. And that's the problem. When you look at energy policy or general accountability and fractionalized federal policy, because when you have special interests sort of cherry-picking and setting up programs that don't create a cohesive solution to our problems, then the problems compound, and we're the ones that pay for it. And that's what's happened over the years. Increasingly, the average American person has paid for it in many ways. It used to be pretty reasonable in the 60s and 70s to expect to work within the trades even and make a good living and expect to put your kids through college and be able to afford to retire at some reasonable time. And now we get the message, you're on your own. You know, all of that doesn't count for anything. And that's wrong. That's fundamentally wrong and flies in the face of what most people in this country believe in. Again, callers can call in at 800-313-9443. That's 800-313-9443. And I also want to mention my website, which is earthpulse.com, EARTHPULSC, earthpulse.com. And you can check out these issues that we've been talking today are actually on a DVD called Changing Earth Changes, The Ripple Effect, and it's right there on the front page at earthpulse.com. So take a look at that, and you can call in today at 800-313-9443, and we'll be continuing this discussion, too, in the next hour on energy issues as well. But going back again to sort of what happened with national interest lands and the development of policy in this area, you know, coming out of the Native Land Claims Settlement Act, we then had National Interest Lands Reserve, and those all got set up. What happens when, in times of crisis, is you always attack the toughest one to undo. You know, and so in this case, it's the ANWR. That's the one that's gotten all the news across the country. They want to open the ANWR for rural development, and there's a lot of environmental concerns that are in fact, legitimate concerns. But the real issue isn't that issue at all. It's if you look at a map, and I recommend go to the web and look up a map of Alaska and look for the National Naval Petroleum Reserve on the top of the state, and you're going to see it's much larger than Prudhoe Bay, the existing oil field, and it's much larger than the ANWR, and we already know there's oil there because we found it there, which is why we set up that reserve in the first place. So it's really not so much about ANWR as it is about attacking the most difficult property to get opened back up because of these national interest issues. And that's, again, where there ought to be good public debate. But in that debate, there ought to be full information. We ought to know the facts so we can make the determinations. I mean, why would you want, for instance, to develop an oil field offshore if you had the option of doing it onshore, which is safer by anybody's estimation? And these are the kinds of things that happen often here. It's resources, whether it's fishing resources, being traded off to oil resources. In one case, in Bristol Bay, leases were actually bought back because the fishery there is one of the last major fisheries in the world. The Aleutian Chain and the Alaskan fisheries represent the last and the biggest fishery left in the world. And preserving that is a valuable thing because it's not just about one resource over another. It's a case of recognizing where the risks are and where you don't need to assert those risks. It's not a case of having to do every development. It's a case of making sure we get full information and we develop those things that keep energy prices reasonable and rational. And we're not going to see, you know, I mean, you're not going to see a big decrease. And there's a lot of pressure now to decrease gasoline prices up until the election. But after that election's over, all bets will be off. So whatever you're seeing in the mainstream media about everybody getting upset and the conservatives now saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, you've gone too far and they've been the friends of the industry forever, it's about being reelected right now. And when it's all over, everybody will go back to where they were and the price will escalate. And those of us paying that price are paying it because of a lack of energy policy by this Congress and this administration. And that's what we really need, is that kind of energy policy that stimulates incentives in the right areas for invention and creativity and building new industries in this country when we need them. And with that, we're headed to the break, so we'll be back in a couple of minutes. And again, give a call in if you get a chance at 800-313-9443. Welcome back, Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And today is the first day of this program, and I hope people are sticking with me. I'm a little bit nervous. I've never been on this end of the conversation. It's kind of interesting, not having the kind of questions put to me by other hosts that I've worked with throughout the years is a little bit different. But I hope everyone's staying with me on the issues. You know, these are issues I've never really had the opportunity, except on this network, to really explore. You know, it was on another program, you know, aired right here that we talked about energy issues a number of months ago. And, you know, what struck me is how little of this history has been captured and remembered and put together. And I guess it's like a lot of things. You know, you don't pay attention as it comes in bite-sized bits unless you're, you know, unless you're really close or involved or interested in the issues, like all of these issues. You know, energy policy, again, when you start to think about it, you know, there's been a lot of debate by Republicans and Democrats. You know, to me, it's left-wing, right-wing, same bird in terms of what ends up happening to most of us. These interests have really not developed a solution or an answer, and this is part of the problem. You know, even the basic obvious things, you know, it used to be incentives for invention, you know, and creativity that solves the nation's problems. Maybe we need to see that happen again, which encourages invention. Maybe we need to see the kind of R&D tax credits for individuals and small organizations that need those opportunities to look at alternatives. And at the same time, you know, looking at the suppression of technology, you know, there's been a lot of stories over the years and a lot of published material validating how much technology has been suppressed over the decades. And I think we need congressional action on that issue. You know, we need to change the rules. If you're suppressing a technology that's in the national interest, which includes alternative energy technologies, and they're being suppressed to not bring them to market, but keep them from the marketplace, I think we need government intervention. I think that's where it works against us. That's where the exclusivity of invention works against the average person. And yet the inventor certainly deserves the reward of his invention. There needs to be legislation worked out to make sure inventors are rewarded and companies are rewarded for investing money in R&D, but not to keep it off the market, but in fact to provide solutions and reserve that creative right return on that creativity that they're entitled to. But those rules and those laws, again, need to be addressed, because right now what happens in patent law, you know, American companies, small organizations file their patents. Somebody internationally steals the idea and produces it, and if you got a couple $1 million, you might find some justice. There is no justice, because most people that are small inventors, they don't have a couple $1 million to engage in that kind of litigation, and then they spend their life litigating as opposed to continuing their inventive process and solving other problems that are useful to get resolved. There needs to be a different approach to the small inventor and stimulation to creativity on that level, and this can be done in lots of different ways, but it needs to be done effectively and creatively to get solutions, you know, into the market as rapidly as possible. Suppression of technology perhaps is the biggest crime when you think about the manipulation of economies and markets, because free markets would allow this creativity to flow forward, wouldn't restrict the ability to move ideas to the marketplace that provide solutions. And we need solutions. We need new industries in this country to replace those that we've been sold out from under. You know, the fact of the matter is, where we have the lead, and we still maintain the lead, is intellectual capacity and creativity. We need to start rewarding it, recognizing it, stimulating it, and changing the way we all see the world. This has been Nick Begich for the first hour, and we'll catch you right after the top of the hour break. The Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And today is the first day of this program. It's going to air Wednesdays this same time for 2 hours, the earlier hour and this hour. That's Wednesday on the Republic Broadcasting Network, and we appreciate people dialing in today. We're going to take a call from Marilyn in California. Go ahead, Marilyn.
Hi, Dr. Begich. I'm so glad to hear you on RBN. I've followed you on Southwest Radio Church and several other places, and everything you talk about is of interest to me. Hope you can
see that. I appreciate that.
I got a question about, kind of related to what you're talking about. I come from a family that was involved in oil since the mid-40s. My dad worked at what used to be called Standard Oil in New Jersey. And I'm from Louisiana down there, Russell Long territory. And I've been interested in, of course, you talk about weather modification is another thing you talk about.
Right.
And then, of course, the manipulation of oil prices. And I feel like a lot of this global warming that, you know, first I thought it was junk science, but now I realize there could be something going on, which, and I think you believe that too, am I correct?
That's right. I think it's primarily natural causes, unlike what most people hear in the mainstream. But man is certainly throwing another rock on that camel's back right now.
Well, you know, being from San Francisco Bay Area, and I've been down to L.A., you can see the spraying almost every day. Now, if this is going on in a lot of places, which people claim it is, this would trap heat and could artificially cause a global warming. Would you care to address that, or do you think that could be
possible? Sure. Actually, there was a study done in the early 1980s, and it was when Dallas-Fort Worth Airport was expanding dramatically, and they were looking at just the normal contrails from jet aircraft, the normal vapor trails. And what they found is that even way back then, which is way back then when you consider air traffic since that time, they determined that it was adding to the power of storm fronts in southeast United States. Now, if you take and look at that, they could never prove this theory until 9/11, when they shut down air traffic in the United States, and they could quantify their models, and they determined that, in fact, they were dead on right. But the difference was between 1980s, early 80s, when those observations and theories were first put forward, and now today we've had increases in air traffic by many, many times. And as a consequence, we're adding even more into this equation. But nature releases even more energy, and that's what isn't being considered. And the debate about sort of what the cause is, we're going to have that debate until the cows come home. What we need to recognize is it's changing, and every one of us living anywhere in the world can say it's changing. So we need to address what do those changes mean for food production, transportation, energy costs, and how do we address those problems, not for just today, for 10 and 15 years down the road, because if they don't get addressed now, we'll never build the infrastructure to address them then.
Well, if your thesis is that it's changing because of natural causes, then actually what we would have to do would be to do the same thing that the Kyoto Protocol type proponents are doing and literally turn us into a third world nation. Is that the kind of thing you'd like to see happen, or?
Not at all. In fact, just the opposite, because I think there's an abundance of energy resources which you can utilize that don't necessarily add to the problem. And at least from the standpoint of national policy, let's assume that everybody is right saying that it's not oil and gas. But is it in our national interest to pay $70 a barrel for oil and gas and for our public to pay what it costs for energy? And the answer to that is no. And the alternatives have nothing to do so much with do we blame one industry or another. It's to say, what do we do to get this country energy independent, no matter what the cause of the changes in climate that we're seeing. And in Europe, it's going to be the opposite problem. As that Atlantic heat engine slows down because of the melting of Greenland, which is a big change. It's actually melting at five times the rate it was melting only 5 years ago. So you have Europe getting cooler, having more problems in terms of energy there. We're getting hotter in Alaska. There's other energy considerations in the U.S. that are quite different. But all of those things end up costing you and I ultimately, unless our industry and government get to look at those alternatives. Welcome back to Change the Way We World with Dr. Nick Deggett. And I'd like to give my website a couple of times and a toll-free number where you can reach us if you're interested in the subject today. We're talking about Earth Changes, The Ripple Effect, which is a DVD we've produced, and I'll get back to Marilyn in 1 minute. That website is earthpulse.com. And we also have a toll-free at 888-690-1277. Again, 888-690-1277. Thank you so much. And Marilyn, are you still with me?
Yes, there was a couple other things I wanted to say about. Now, I really do believe that they're suppressing alternative forms of energy. I have no problem with that thesis. I know I worked for an oil company for many years, and at one point for about 3 years I worked on a photovoltaic project that they put together, and it was obvious just a tax write-off because they did not push forward with some of the things that were discovered during that little, step into the other world, I guess you'd call it.
Right.
The only thing I have a problem with is I really do believe that there are some very concerted efforts to actually cause this global warming problem by artificial means. And, I mean, you've even cited some of them in some of your talks, things that could have been done.
Yes, absolutely.
I know at one point when I first started working, I ran an ASTM smoke test on diesel fuel, jet fuel, JP4. It used to be you can't put that much stuff into the air by law. They had certain requirements. Now, what's going on? Yeah, it's very
A couple things. You know, Joyce Riley brought up a new jet fuel that was being used in a lot of aircraft that's problematic, at its inception for the same reasons. The thing about jet exhaust generally contributing to the problem, it does add to cumulus cloud formation, something that definitely we know. The science has shown that. But again, kind of throwing the burden on human beings. Now, they talk about the heating of the oceans as being the biggest driver for weather. And if you look at that, the thesis that's being put forward is that, global warming is the sun light hitting the surface of the ocean and warming it up and creating these El Nino effects, and ozone being depleted allows it to radiate more intensely. But the reality is, in the oceans, as you go deeper, it gets cooler, and heat rises as a basic rule of physics. That heat is generated by the sun. Most is reflected away. A lot of it gets trapped in the atmosphere. But the oceans themselves don't heat up very rapidly in that way. But if you look at other factors, such as undersea volcanics, which contribute energy in a much different way, when the energy comes out of venting under the seas, 100% of that energy is absorbed into the ocean very rapidly and efficiently, and it doesn't dissipate until it appears as a plume on the surface of the ocean and dissipates in the form of heat. And if you look at just the South Pacific, there's over 1,200 charted undersea volcanoes. At any given time, a number of them are venting, but we're not monitoring that venting, at least not in the open literature. But when you start to look at those kind of natural factors driving the heat engines, even in the area of the Bahamas, there's active volcanoes in that part of the Atlantic. So, are we looking at these other factors? The answer is no. And these are probably the bigger contributors. But the reality is, and you asked me about, do we have to accept a third world lifestyle? And I don't believe that for a minute. In fact, I believe just the opposite. If we solve our energy problems, which right now suck up about 35% of our economy, and we reduce that percentage, we free up resources to solve other problems. And energy should be a national, we should be in a national recognition of a national emergency and an energy solution, and we're not. We're not even at the beginning of that discussion, going into an election year with the highest prices of energy we've ever seen that are going to literally kill people in their homes this winter we can't afford to pay those bills. And this is something that we could have been resolving long ago, and we can still resolve today to bring prosperity back to this country instead of the poverty in which we're headed if we continue the national policies on trade and oil and gas and the other major issues that affect each and every one of them.
Don't you think it's interesting that George Bush, in his one of his last addresses, made this strange comment, oil man that he is, that we must develop alternative forms of energy? That's nothing but a red herring. I don't think it means anything to you.
Not to him. But here's what happens when your ratings are so far in the latrine. They haven't been that low since the last oil crisis and the things that led up to it, which was the Nixon administration. You got a corrupt corporate government today, just like we have been, just like we've had for decades. But people are waking up, and people are mad. And when the average person is affected in this country, everybody knows you're 5 minutes to midnight to the big change. And, that's what people are worried about. And I'm not talking about some violent upset, in the country. I'm talking about the same kinds of things that happen in other governments around the world. When the average person doesn't have to stand around and wait for leadership to appear, they recognize they're standing in those shoes, and they begin to act on what they know to be right and true. And this country is about to emerge in that vein because the average person now is being negatively affected. And even those who have been the advocates for the industry recognize and are shaking with fear because when the American public wakes up, everyone in the world knows they got a huge problem. And that's what our government needs to recognize. The American public is waking up because of conversations like this. And if we can wake enough people up, things do change. And they're responding to that wake-up call that's happening right now. And energy is going to be one of those issues where we have a chance to really change the character of the country if we recognize it as the biggest national security issue of all.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thanks. Appreciate the call. I think we still got Paul hanging in, so maybe we can get him off time. And let me give that call-in number again. It's 800-313-9443. Again, 800-313-9443 if you want to continue this conversation. Paul, are you still there? Guess not. Looks like we lost you somewhere along the way. Call back in, Paul, and we'll get you on. Let's go back again to talk a little bit about sort of where all this, may be headed. Here, again, looking at sort of where it goes in the future and the discussion that Marilyn just had working for the industry and knowing what they were doing in photovoltaics, using solar radiation. And, what happens in many cases is these do get suppressed, but there's some recognition by the industry that eventually somebody somewhere more dependent on external sources of energy than we are calls those solutions to happen. Other governments spend a lot of money on alternative energy. Japan is a good example. They don't have raw materials, so if they develop the next technology and advance it, the industry will lose. So what does the industry do to hedge their bet is make sure they have enough energy interest in those alternatives, so if they start to move that direction, they have the cash to move into the markets. And I think they have to see the handwriting on the wall, which is why oil prices have been inflated, not just to cough up the dollar right now for political reasons, to get their cronies reelected again this session, but also to sort of dampen the impact, because if you've got a corporation that's got billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars available to fund with cash new industries, they're going to dominate those new industries and keep us under the same stranglehold that multinationals have kept us under in terms of energy as it relates to national policy, again, contributing probably 30-35% of the entire U.S. economy is energy-based, and we're consuming about a third of all the energy in the world, although that's decreasing rapidly as China's demands and other demands increase, again, because of bad foreign policy. Paul, are you with us now down there in Florida? Your name on the prompter, but I guess you're still not able to get...
Nick?
Are you
hearing
me? Yeah, now I got you, Paul.
Oh, great. Yeah, you were the one who wrote the book Angels Don't Play This Harp?
That's correct.
Okay, I read that some years ago. It was very interesting, and I heard you on Coast to Coast several times. And my question was this. Number one, does harp broadcast on shortwave? And off the top of your head, can you give me a couple of frequencies?
It's a narrow band, and I can't off the top, but if you go to the, there's an official HARP website that'll give you at least their primary broadcasting signal. But the thing to remember is that HARP, and for those that don't know, it's the large radio array here in Alaska, but it's been discussed in other publications that we've made. In fact, we got great articles on it that people can look at for free on our website at earthpulse.com. But this facility is just one of many. It also affects up to what are called 16 decades of frequency, from ultra-low to visible light, by stimulating secondary effects in the environment. What HARP is, for those that have absolutely no idea what we're talking about right at the moment, it is an experimental project here in Alaska. It's been the subject of a lot of radio discussion over the years and lots of news over the years, but it is one of those technologies that, in fact, can interfere with weather systems. The inventor, Bernard Eastland, was actually retained originally by Atlantic Richfield through one of their subsidiaries called Arco Power Technologies, and they were one of the biggest oil and gas producers on the North Slope, and they were looking actually for markets for that natural gas. As I mentioned last hour, there's no pipeline yet to take it to market, although the industry's had it tied up, 35 trillion cubic feet of gas tied up for over 30 years.
Huh. And one more thing, if I might, please. I have an idea that we're getting chemtrail down here on the weekends, and specifically last Sunday I think we got some. Because I know all the patterns for the international flights and the approach and departure for Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood Airport. And this chemtrail was extremely anomalous. Now, I have multiple health problems. I'm going for a checkup in June, and they're going to have a blood test. I'm going to take this test, and are there any particular minerals or excess of certain minerals in the blood that I could check for? I know there's, I heard there's aluminum and barium in these things.
Well, you know, there's some problems with that, and let me describe a couple of them. One of them, the aluminum issue, in your part of the country, if you look at the soils just north of you, there are the orangish-colored soils that you have there.
Yeah, up in Georgia.
Right. These are all aluminum-based materials. There's also a bauxite deposit in the Bahamas on top of a coral bed, which isn't theoretically supposed to happen. What they found is that aluminum in particular, in a doctoral dissertation that was published in a book called The Secret Lies of Dust, was actually coming into the Sahara. Right after the break, we'll get back in this very important issue that you raised, Paul. Welcome back. Ain't the way the world, but about 6 seconds. And today is the first day. We're going to be doing this every Wednesday for a couple of hours from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Central Time. So if you're tuning in for the first time, just coming into this program, it is the first time that we've done this as a host. So it's a little different position from what I've done in the past. But I appreciate being here and the opportunity to talk about these issues. Paul had just raised, just before the break, this question about aluminum and barium in coming down in the atmosphere across the country. And the issue of aluminum I was starting to address. It actually been a book that was published called The Secret Life of Dust, and it was originally a doctoral dissertation looking at dust flows around the planet. What they determined is the majority of the very fine particulate material that accounts for the orangish soil in the southeastern United States actually was deposited over millions of years based on dust flows coming out of the Sahara Desert. Now, when you look at this in the modern context, the other thing that gets carried is everybody's experimental materials or other toxins that are invested in the environment. The other place where we see this is coming in from Asia right now, which is carrying loads of heavy metals, barium included, lots of toxic materials because of no restrictions on that. They come in dust flows that hit from the lower or the upper reaches of Mexico all the way through British Columbia and the western United States and do the same thing. And these are account for most of the aluminum that people are finding within sampling that's taking place on the ground or in the atmosphere. Now, the barium is another one that's an interesting one because it's used for, in Alaska, for instance, they take barium-laden rockets. They push particles of barium into the upper atmosphere, and then utilizing the HARP system, they can actually stimulate effects around the naturally occurring magnetic lines that surround the Earth. And these are done for learning more about radio propagation, the effect of being able to transfer radio signals and manipulate signals. And so barium is used atmospherically for experimentation all over the world with very, very little restriction. It's a highly toxic material, and a lot of countries have no restriction.
You know, the reason I asked was that I've noticed what could be chemtrails down here for the last 3 to 4 years. And I can notice, I do have multiple non-related health problems, too, but I have noticed in the last 3 or 4 years a very noticeable deterioration of my short-term memory and my attention span. And
do you use portable home phones or cell phones at all?
No, I do not. No.
Okay. That's a big issue for short-term memory loss these days. People don't realize these home portable phones have the same potential effects as cell phones.
Yeah, I was aware of that, but I don't use anything like that, so I cannot attribute it to the high-frequency transmission close to the brain. But I was specifically worried about the I thought it might be the chemtrails, because I noticed a deterioration about the same time that I noticed these chemtrails, what I think were chemtrails. I can't be sure. But I can notice a checkerboard pattern in these things, and I can notice the way these vapor trails disperse. I know what they look like, and I know they're putting new chemicals in jet fuel now, but even so, they disperse in a very, very slow, strange manner, and it's very noticeable.
And I think there's experimentation certainly going on, because the reports are certainly widespread, but again, we want to look at all of the possibilities, and this is what doesn't always happen. When you start to look at the sources of where this material comes from. You know, one of the big places where this was reported as well was sort of the upper Midwest, lower parts of central Canada, where the biggest aluminum factories were set up.
Yeah.
And that certainly contributes, when you think about it, before the Clean Air Act of the U.S. and the equivalent acts in Canada, all that fine particulate material went up the stack, and every time now the wind blows, it gets kicked back up again. And you know, we really need to be careful on our sampling, but the problems are really get back to the root problems, which is accountability, you know, by both government, science, and industry. And that's what's lacking in a lot of this. If they politicize it, get us all fighting with each other over the cause, well, everybody's running off with the bank. And we're the ones that are the victims in the end, when we ought to be living in a very much different kind of world. You know, when we looked at supposedly a peace dividend, what dividend did that realize for anybody? You know, we got higher taxes, less disposable income than we've ever had.
Yeah.
We had more bailouts of industry than we've ever had, and yet the average guy keeps working our way down the ladder. You know, and that's all. And it's because we're being traded off against multinational interests that aren't our interests, that aren't our national interests, and energy ought to be the number one national interest issue right now, because it's sucking all of our resources into fighting wars over those kinds of resources.
Thank you for your response. And if I find, I'm going to ask them specifically to check for aluminum and barium when they do that blood test. If I find anything unusual coming back, I'll give you a call and let you know.
All right, that'd be great. And we'll be here every Wednesday, so do definitely give us the feedback. We'd appreciate hearing it.
All right, thank you, Nick.
Thanks for being
with us. Okay,
bye-bye. Hey, again, callers can reach us at 800-313-9443 if you want to get on today and ask a few questions or make some comments or bring up some of the other issues that you know we've covered in the past. There's a lot of material on the energy issue that we can still get into, and we can do that. Well, I got Asher and Austin, so let's bring them up.
Yeah, I'm here.
All right, go ahead.
Okay, why don't we just go ahead? There's a bunch of companies out there that already have the capability of doing this. What we need to do is support those companies and boycott the companies that are selling the oil. That would be one solution.
Absolutely. You know, there's lots of sources for alternative energy to be applied at a small scale or elsewhere. We're headed for the break. Stick with me, and we'll catch right after the break. Welcome back. Away from the world. Today again is the first day of this program. We're going to be airing every Wednesday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Central Time. So stay tuned with us, and we'll cover a lot of subjects over the next few months. And hopefully, we'll get some feedback from folks as to what you really want to want to focus on, and we'll be able to get some good guests and be able to comment on our own research in the course of that. We had Asher in Austin, and we were talking about this this issue of alternate energies and supporting those that really are out there doing the leading stuff on these on breakthrough technologies, trying to get off that train where we're having to be dependent solely on the industry, the oil industry. And, you know, in the case of rural America, going back again to those principles that, that we used to apply, you know, there's a lot of solutions if you start looking at, you know, what all is out there. You know, there's a company I know, they've been on the web forever. They've got a solar book alone that's 2 inches thick. You know, they got little micro hydroelectrics, a lot of different technologies out there, as well as this network promotes a number of technologies at the network's store. And I think that's where you can really begin to vote with your dollars. The other place is put some pressure on your congressional delegation this year. You know, we got elections coming up. Let's ask what those policies are going to be to stimulate creativity in this area and get us off of this this wagon that we've been riding down way, way too long. We should be independent in energy. We should have been after the 1973 OPEC oil embargo. And if you look at what has been spent to defend the country's energy policies in terms of war, foreign aid, assistance, involvement, and fractionalization of public policy, and you see a long 33-year history of bad news. And that bad news needs to be replaced with leadership for a change. And that's where each of us can begin to engage our political leadership and demand a solution in terms of the energy issues and energy areas.
Well, the solution, sir, is yourself. If you do not allow yourself to be manipulated and controlled by these energy companies and take the initiative to get yourself off these, you know, these issues as far as oil, electrical companies, municipalities, you will be able to gain a freedom that they can't take from you. And the only freedom that they can take from you is the technology of making the parts for what you need. But you can remember, in the olden days, they used water wheels. I mean, you can make yourself, you know, collectible water, and on RBN, they sell those filters where you can clean your water. So you can also support the company, you know, RBN itself by doing that.
Yes.
And then you can also sustain yourself with minerals through the wheatgrass. I mean, it's just up to you. If you allow yourself to be a slave, then be a slave. I just don't want to be a slave anymore. They sent my father to Vietnam. They sent my brother to this new war. But do any of those chicken hawks have any of their family out there? No. This is a diversionary tactic to keep us from being not a slave.
You're right on target. You know, and if you look at it even a step further, now what have they done? Start to inflate inflation again, starting to artificially raise interest rates, which is jamming people on their mortgages, on those flexible rate mortgages. And it's just another form of taking. I mean, ultimately, it's, again, the middle class, the average person that gets damaged in this formula as we continue to develop.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, sir.
Yeah.
But the problem is these people are allowing themselves to get in that situation, which each person has a God-given right to live free, you know, and Jesus could foresee this and say, hey, one day we're going to be dependent on energy. But and they had the sense to know where to go when it would be cold and when it would be hot. You know, I mean, so we don't have that situation here in America because it's a lockdown society. You have to own your land in order to do these things, and then they have municipalities that won't allow you to do these things. So what you have to do is you have to do it individually. And if you do it individually and boycott the other corporations that are out there, and what can they do? There's 4 points on that, and then I'll let you go. There's 4 points.
All right.
That go exactly what you're talking about. It's the ballot box, it's the soap box, it's the jury box, it's the cartridge box. We need to enlighten.
You're exactly right, and you know it is. It's about changing our approach to being. We're not victims. We have a birthright, a God-given right to solve our own individual problems. And it wasn't ever built on some big squishy collective. It was built on individuals and expressing our character through our living examples. And I think that's...
Exactly. Not King George, but Jesus, God. That's what we had our first revolution for. He's the only king over us. You know, and he wants us to live free and happy. You know, come on.
Absolutely.
It's that simple.
And you know, and responsibly. And, you know, I think that's where our governments have gone astray, because governments are supposed to spring not just from the will of God, but also from the will of the people. And our governments have been shaped and formed by the will of special corporate interests that do not work in our favor. And you're exactly right. Boycotting those interests does make sense, but engaging the political process and installing those leaders that will take that position even further is also a necessary step. And you're right. It's the ballot box, the jury box, and the soapbox that starts to kick
I didn't mean to say the cartridge box, because violence only begets violence as anything that is irrational.
Yeah,
is what the framers of the Constitution did say that, though.
Oh yeah, you know, there's been a lot of issues recently that have brought that back home. But, revolutions start first by a change in the spirit of man and the application of good ideas, and it's not generated by fear and anger, but by the opposite. Because we have a birthright, we have a right to make these changes. It's not just about domination of the earth; it's about responsibility and stewardship about ourselves, each other, and this planet. And this planet was given to us as a gift. And it provides not some restriction. And we need to recognize. And if you read, read Revelations 11:18, it'll tell you what happens to those who destroy the earth. God's clear, just before Armageddon. Those that destroy the earth, he destroys them. It's a responsibility that goes beyond politics. It goes to the heart
of the
world.
And it starts at home. It always starts at home. Just remember that.
Yes.
If you teach your children, if you teach your children the right thing, then how can they not teach their children the right thing? Go ahead, I'm sorry.
We've got another caller hanging in there, Asher. So
okay, groovy. Groovy, brother. Hang in there and do the right thing, and everyone become energy efficient. And I know it's a tough thing to say, but as far as the car-wise, but you know what? There's a man in Oklahoma that built an engine that runs off of nothing. It propels itself. I forget his name, but there's a video out there that he has a self-propelled engine that it takes more energy to run it than it does to start it, which is physically impossible. Get everyone out there, start looking for this video and looking for this man, and he's somewhere in Oklahoma, and that's the start. But the main thing is we got solar opportunity, wind, water, use them. Thank God and bless you.
Hey, thanks, Asher. Appreciate it. We got Jeff in Massachusetts. You still hanging in there with us?
Oh, yes. Hey, Nick, how's it going?
It's going good. Good to have you on the air.
Oh, yes, Nick. Welcome aboard. And, Nick, I have to buy your book, Angels Don't Play This Harp, because, I think that scalar wave technology, as well as harp, is having a negative influence on the American people. Now my question is, how powerful do you think our Russian scalar wave technology is on basically turning the American people into zombies? Because Stanislav Lunev talked about scalar wave technology to a degree, and other people have talked about it. What do you think of that phenomenon?
Well, I think it's, scalar energy is also mentioned in military literature, and we discussed it a fair amount, and it's kind of the opposite of a vector. You know, when you think about energy coming off, for instance, radio antennas broadcasting this program, the energy starts out at a relatively small area, spreads out as it goes with distance, and it has a distance and time relationship. With a scalar, it doesn't have those relations. It's a very odd form of energy interaction, and it sort of appears everywhere simultaneously, which kind of violates at least all the rules we think are out there. But when you start to see it in the literature, it's this type of energy that may, in fact, be what's behind a lot of the effects on human health and physiology, because what we're finding is it's pulsed electromagnetic fields or pulsed radiating sources. Pulsed energy, pumping the energy in, seems to have the most impressive biological effects on affecting human behavior. We have actually a DVD on this very subject that I produced a while back on controlling the human mind, and it's over there at our website at earthpulse.com. But this issue is also dealt with in a number of publications over the years. We just finished a manuscript. Over 300 sources are cited on this issue of physical manipulation of the mind by external forces. And so I think one of these Wednesdays we'll get into that subject. It's a very important subject. Way too much to cover in time today.
Oh, I know.
Yes, this is a real technology. We'll get into it. Maybe we'll do that on the next week's show. That'll be a good topic, and we've been looking
at it. Great. That's so excellent because, you know what, because this is a dimension and what's causing a lot of this craziness, plus the pumping of drugs into this country through the Russians, through the Czechs, through the people in South America. There was a book written by Dr. Joseph Douglas on the subject. When you start reading the Russian defectors, you will find that this country is basically finished, and the only hope is to run for the hills.
Well, you know, we can't. Here's where I disagree. As I agreed to do this program because this network stands for truth. It stands for getting the word out. It stands for trying to make a difference and make a change. And I think we still have that opportunity. It's going to be at the 11th hour. It's going to be 2 minutes till midnight because that's how the American public is. In fact, most countries are built that way. You don't really jump into the political arena anymore unless you're forced there, it seems like, for at least the massive population. And, you know, we're getting there because we're all feeling a lot of pain right now. I mean, it affects everyone what's happening in the ways our government's going. And even our government is recognizing, and other governments are recognizing, their weakness in all of this. And this is where we really need solutions. We cannot succumb to fear. We cannot succumb to those things. And I'll tell you, when we talk about mind manipulation and what happens within the human brain, when you experience negative emotions, if you look at an EEG, the brain pattern of the individual experiencing those emotions, you'll see incoherent, all over the map kind of patterns. Whereas if you're experiencing positive emotions, love, compassion, empathy, you get very rhythmic patterns, the kind that lend themselves to good thinking and the higher levels of thinking that human beings are called to exhibit. And this is where, again, you know, there's clear messages in every religious philosophy on the planet to not succumb to fear. And this is the root of it. It's based on pure science. And as science says, when we start to succumb to fear and we head for the hills is when we've already lost the battle. And this is a battle worth fighting. It's worth fighting on the principles that made the country great. And that's on individual sovereignty first as the starting point, and from that sovereignty, taking our government back. This network is about that. That's why I'm on this network today, and hopefully we can turn this around. And it gets to, you know, we all feel defeated at times. It's a tough thing to wake up every day and look at what's going on around you and not be impacted by it. But there are little things, and there are no, in my estimation, really little things. There's lots of things that each of us can do to contribute to change in our own communities, whether it's the issues we've talked about today or other issues that people are centered around and are important to them. But the key is, and this is what I believe is the ultimate act of faith, is stepping into what you know to be right and true, acting on what you know to be right and true, and attempting by informing your neighbor, calling your congressman. I mean, every little bit adds up. And when I say there's no little things, I always use this illustration. It's the guy walking down the road who smiles at the person passing him, and that person passing was on the way to kill themselves, and that one little bit of human compassion changed their mind. Maybe that's the individual that cures cancer. You know, I mean, it's that kind of putting something out there that represents who you are as a human being in a positive, forceful way that results in change. And it happens by all of us recognizing we're connected to the most powerful thing on the planet, which is this organic, what I call an organic internet. It's called the human race. And if we claim our birthright, take it back, and we begin to express ourselves as created in the image of the Creator, as we were intended, this planet will change.
Well, I say this, I welcome you on the program, and if I didn't believe that there was any hope, I wouldn't even call it to end the radio show.
I know, I know, it's the same thing we all feel, and it's not and it's no criticism, because, I mean, I go through it, believe me. My wife will tell you, I cycle through times when I just look and I go, you know what, are we doing the right thing? But there's always something that encourages me and says, you know what, don't give it up yet.
I won't. Let me throw this out as a simple closing note, which I said this on many other programs, which is there is a five-step stage, and once this gets into motion, it's the point of no return. Number one, when oil prices spike up to where the economy collapses, then you'll have internal unrest in the inner cities, and I believe that will be caused by Russian scalar wave technology, plus the drugs have been pumped into this country. And then once the inner cities, a.k.a. ghettos, blow up, then the First Amendment will be eliminated, then the Second Amendment will be eliminated, and then the U.N. foreign troops will come into this country as the enforcement arm to break the brown shirts in this country. You see, all these radical groups are being used as the brown shirts, and the U.N. troops who are coming into this country will be used as the black shirts. And then that is when, ipso facto, America is finished.
Yep. There was a book published back in the 80s that was called The Ominous Parallel, and it was called The End of Freedom in America. And it's a book I read years ago. In fact, I'm pulling it off the shelf because it's still an important one. It was written in 1982. Okay.
Wow.
And it was talking about the rise of the Republican right in terms of how they were manipulating public policy. And this writer ascribed the same methods used in Nazi Germany were being applied here. And if you look over the last 21, 22 years, you know, you see how it's played out. And again, it's not left or right. You know, these guys up at the top are selling us out a wholesale to whatever interest they're pandering to, and it's not the public's interest anymore. You know, our U.S. Senator from Alaska, Ted Stevens, is an embarrassment to me. I mean, he wears a Hulk tie and acts like a tyrant. So that is not public service. That's public disservice because he's acting as a tyrant for multinational corporations rather than the interest of the average person. And he brings back the pork, so he keeps getting reelected. And it's not about the pork anymore. It's about doing the right thing, which means sometimes you're going to have to say, no, we can't do it. Hey, we're going to a break, so we'll come back in a few minutes. I think we're up for the last segment. Change the way the world talks to Vegas, and this program will be airing regularly on Wednesdays from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. Central Time. So tune in again next week when we're back on again. And next week, based on the last couple of conversations with callers, I think we'll talk about the idea of physical control of the mind and what's happened with technologies and how they've advanced over the years. I think that was a really great issue that our last caller just raised. We've probably got time for one more caller at 800-313-9443 if someone wants to dial in. And while we have a minute or two, I want to give our toll-free numbers if you want to get information on any of the products that we carry. EarthPulse.com is the website, and the toll-free is 888-690-1277. Again, 888-690-1277 to contact Earth Pulse on these issues or other issues that we've covered over the years. You know, again, going back to sort of where we began today was a discussion of sort of the effects of Alaskan politics on national energy and minerals policy. I think this is a very important issue that we're going to bring up again in future programs because we are at a time when we need solutions. I mean, and we need to recognize that energy issues are the big ones. You know, there's a lot of good independent experimentation going on around the planet. You know, the best inventions in the world were done in the face of what the science community said could never happen. I mean, go back to the Wright brothers, and here's a couple of bicycle makers that believed you could fly with a heavier-than-air craft when no scientists in the world would buy into it. And they did it. You know, look at Apple computers, starting with a bunch of guys in a garage believing you could create something smaller than a computer that filled up a building. And they did it. You know, take a look at all the things that impact us the most in life, whether it's science, politics, religion, or business. And it happens with the maverick, the guy that steps out of the frame and does something creative, with the individual, as one of our callers said today, is where it begins. And, you know, this is where we have opportunity to recognize that that's where ultimately these solutions are. And someone's going to come to them. And when they do, everything changes. And with energy policy, we already have the solution. What we need is the right infrastructure to insist that those solutions come forward. That means, in my view, a review, again, of the patent rights, the things that allow people to tie up intellectual property in an unfair and unreasonable way that works against humanity. We need whistleblower mechanisms and tools to stop that from happening and make sure technology serves humankind rather than enslaves us. That's something that we have said throughout the years, that what we're talking about in this program every week on Wednesdays is going to be about technology and its impacts and how these things roll up into the economy, into our science, and where the big breakthroughs possibly are that can really make some changes. And so we'll try and bring in guests to deal with those issues as well, people I've met around the world as I've lectured and met with folks. I think this would be a good opportunity to really get into the issues that really will make a change. And, you know, who knows? You know, maybe this becomes the springboard for even stimulating some of those ideas and actions. I want to mention a couple of other sites before I go off. We have all of our research today is being funded now by the Lay Institute on Technology. And I serve as their executive director. Check that website, layinstitute.org. And thanks for being with me today on Changing the Way the World is Done. Thank you.